Hello and welcome to Aspen Physician Spotlight. My name is Vikram Christian. I'm a pediatric gastroenterologist at the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis. And today I have the honor and privilege of interviewing Dr. Robert Martindale. Dr. Martindale, welcome. Thank you for taking the time to talk with me today.
Thank you. Thanks for doing the interview. That's great.
Dr. Martindale, definitely not a stranger to the Aspen community, but he is a professor of surgery in the Division of Gastrointestinal and General Surgery at the Oregon Health Sciences University. So, Dr. Martindale, I actually wanted to start off, and this is something we've been doing for a lot of our interviewees, is to talk a little bit more about, I guess, how you got interested in nutrition. What led you to a career in nutrition?
Oh, it's a circuitous route, sort of like all the things in my life, it seems like. I wasn't planning originally to do nutrition. I was working in a lab at UCLA during the summers when I was going to school in Northern California to be a forest ranger. And I worked in a lab at UCLA in the summertime to make a few dollars to pay for my time up in the forestry school. And I got very interested in human physiology. And so my major professor, when I was finishing my undergraduate degree, said, you know, we'd like you to come work for us and come to UCLA, you know, as a grad student. I said, well, not sure. But anyway, so I ended up joining the department, nutrition department at UCLA to get a PhD. So that's how I got into it. But it was purely by chance that my professor said, we'd really like you to come back here and work rather than going on to forestry. I said, well, no, I'm still going to do forestry. He said, well, why don't you apply for the master's program or PhD program and just see how it goes. So I did. And that's, you know.
No, oh, interesting.
So no longer a forestry ranger.
That's okay. Thankful for the ask. Thankful for that. So it's quite a big jump from a forestry ranger to, you know, working in a lab. What were you working on at that time?
In those days, we were doing the isolated perfused pancreas. I worked in a lab which had, in a building which had people that were amazing, brilliant people who were discovering new things all the time. And I found the whole environment at the lab to be very exciting and, you know, understanding. And you know, we had a Martin Grossman who was won the Lasker Award, which is a prestigious award. And so he was a co-discoverer of H2 blocker with Dr. Gregory from London. So there were two of them. And, you know, starting to work there and being around these people that seemed to love their work and love their job. And I thought this might be a good fit, you know. So ended up staying on for a PhD program.
Wow. And then how do you make the jump from there to getting into surgery and then nutrition?
Well, when I was finishing my PhD degree, I interviewed for a job at University of California, Berkeley. And because of the politics at the time, they were not offering tenure. And I had a child at the time, and I said, you know, I'm not sure I can, you know, work somewhere right and not guaranteed tenure. I was worried about having a job, you know, as just a PhD alone. So all of my colleagues who were MD PhDs all said, man, just go to medical school. I said, no, I don't. You know, that's I don't want to spend 4 more years. Oh, no, just go to medical school. No problem. You know, then you don't have to worry about a job, you know. So I had the PhD or finishing, near finished, and then I decided to go to medical school. The Army, I joined the Army to pay for the medical school. So.
Wow, interesting. And I think your knowledge of biochemistry has always amazed me, Dr. Martindale. Whenever I've, you know, listened to your talk, it really takes me back to medical school but connects the dots really between you know, basic sciences and, you know, clinical nutrition and what we do on a daily basis. So I think that definitely comes out in your practice, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. I've been in a teaching situation my entire career. And I feel if a person understands why they're in a situation they're in, like I used to teach a course in the clinical relevance of the Krebs cycle. And, you know, for the medical students, and they'd all just roll their eyes. I go, oh, yeah, Krebs cycle. Yeah, I know that, you know. and then they'd realize that, man, I'm going to use this every day. Acid-base balance and, you know, potassium flux and everything else and enzyme regulation. They started to realize this stuff is important, you know. So I've maintained that. And, you know, I get excited when I start talking about the Krebs cycle. Sometimes the residents roll their eyes, you know. But I think they understand that that's good to know the basic science.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, connecting that to the field of nutrition, do you feel like you rely on that knowledge as you provide nutritional care to patients?
Oh, absolutely. I run the nutrition section at the hospital. And so I have a resident on my nutrition service every day. So we see consults every day. And then in between cases in the operating room, I'll go and see a consult, you know. Mm-hmm. And then we also run the outpatient clinic. So we see short bowel patients and those. So, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm literally using nutrition every day of my life.
Mm-hmm. And I know some of those, because I spent some time with you at OHSU on the Nestle Fellowship, I know that some of those consults can be pretty complex. Can you give us an example of just complex nutritional scenarios or issues that you've encountered?
Yeah, I mean, it can be really anything, you know, difficulty in feeding because of motility, like something like scleroderma with GI dysmotility or severe gastroparesis or mm-hmm. diabetes or sometimes all of that, you know. Mm-hmm. And then we have to go to parenteral, and we end up with some liver failure. And so we change the lipid source around. And as you know, well, with being a pediatric surgeon, the Megavan issues and all those things. So, you know, I'm at a meeting now, in fact, here in Boston, that where the whole meeting is on the SPMs, which are derivatives of the fish oils, you know, mm-hmm. specialized trouble resolving mediators. And I, to me, that's really a field which is becoming very exciting. And I think the future for all of us in medicine is going to realize we can now use nutritional agents to treat a lot of these diseases, you know, whether it be inflammatory bowel disease or dysmotility or, you know, sepsis. We can, you know, I think the age of nutrition now is really taken off because we've realized sometimes a medication, every medication you can think of has a side effect. Mm-hmm. But guess what? We have now, you know, some of these lipid derivatives and protein derivatives that may not have too many side effects, you know, because they're natural products just delivered in the right time in the right way. So,
can you tell us a little bit more about SPMs? I know that's super exciting to you and something that I've heard of as well, but I'm not super familiar with.
Yeah, SPMs are what they used to be called resolvins, but then when they realized there was more than one class of them, they decided there were so many of them, they just rename them. So about, I guess about 7 years ago, they renamed them to specialized pro-resolving mediators. Mm-hmm. And they're endogenously produced end products of fish oil metabolism. So DHA makes the E source, so, you know, different class, and then and EPA makes a different class. Mm-hmm. And those mediators literally can influence almost everything we look at. We look at America today, what's killing us? Inflammatory diseases. Well, these regulate the inflammation. These enhance resolution of inflammation. You know, the joke is here at this meeting, of course, these are all, resolutionists, as we call each other, because we believe in resolving the inflammation. You know, we even have these little buttons. You know, this little button says, start the resolution. I don't know if you can read it. Let me see.
Not really.
Yeah.
Start. Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. You know, it's because I think we're saying before we can heal, we have to resolve the inflammatory process. You know, normal natural resolution, we used to think that the things just dissipated away, the pro-inflammatory cytokines and mediators just dissipated away until the wound healed or the injured liver healed or the, you know, after a stroke, it just healed. Well, now we know that once these are activated, they enhance resolution, you know, by causing the macrophage to engulf the neutrophils and they go into what they call a ferrocytosis. So it's a fascinating area where we actually may be able to see these chronic diseases, which we've been treating, whether it be asthma, arthritis, atherosclerosis, all these diseases are just failures of resolving an inflammatory process. So now, you know, IBD, everything, you know, you think about all these diseases, if we can get to resolve them, and now to be at this meeting with the guys who, you know, discovered resolvins, it's fascinating. Charlie Sirhan, who's the sort of the father of the whole concept, is here, and we've spent lots of time with him. It's, you know, he invited all of his past postdocs and people he knows in the area. So there's, you know, we have 12 speakers and 400 people registered for this meeting.
Wow.
just that are the guy world's experts in resolve. I've just enjoyed giving my talk yesterday. I gave sort of the clinical side of it, but a lot of these guys are hardcore scientists, you know.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating, Dr. Mandel. And, you know, as a pediatric GI doctor, I definitely have used dietary therapies to treat inflammatory bowel disease. It seems like it's a bigger deal in pediatrics more than adults, though. But it's something that we see, you know, on a day-to-day basis, that we see dietary therapies work and help in resolving inflammation. So that's great. It seems like it's already clinically applicable and maybe will become more so over time.
Oh, yeah. Once we learn how exactly to use these and how to deliver the substrate, it's going to be mainstream.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know kind of along that same topic, I know we've had conversations about food and its effect on the microbiome. And I know that's something that's, you know, passionate for you, and, you know, you're passionate about that. I know that you have some experience with that at OHSU. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, man, the microbiome story, you know, it's interesting. Over the years, it's become stronger and stronger. You know, 25 years ago, when I met people that were working with the microbiome, and I thought, you know, this is very interesting. If this really, it's very complex because you're dealing with 1,000 species of bacteria. But if this looks like it's going to go where it looks like it's going, it's going to be very exciting and something, again, we can use. And I think that, again, what are we doing in America? We're killing ourselves with what we're eating, you know? You know, as you've seen, all the major publications talking about all the processed foods, and we have ultra processed foods, and, you know, 35 to 40% of the calories consumed in this country are processed food. And, you know, I think we've got to get back to what we evolved in. You know, it's kind of nice to be able to talk about evolution, because I think, you know, we've had, what, 1 million years, man's been around. Evolving, and we evolve with natural products. And in the last 100 years, we decided we know better. So we've added lots of chemicals to let them sit on the shelf. We've degerminated grains to take away the germinal center. You know, we don't want any whole foods anymore. So we take off the husk and get pure white flour, no longer getting any fibers there. So we've changed our microbiome. And we know now from animal studies and even in some primate studies that if you put them back on a natural food diet, they do better in surgery. They do better in trauma. They do better in you know, prevention of disease. So I think that's something we got to get across to the American public, is we've got to quit eating stuff that comes out of packages that have been sitting on a shelf for 6 months, you know?
Mm-hmm. Where do you see that, practically speaking, with your patients who are undergoing surgeries or who are critically ill in the ICU? How do you take that to the bedside?
Yeah, we take that to the bedside. Like now we know that the basically colon cancer very mm-hmm. commonly associated with an altered microbiome. And so, mm-hmm. for example, when we get ready to do surgery now, we will put the patient on a high fiber diet for a week prior to surgery, 10 days prior mm-hmm. to surgery. We've got animal models that show anywhere from 2 to 4 days of back to a high fiber diet. You know, John Alberti's done a lot of this work. You put animals on a Western diet for a couple of months, okay, and the microbiome shifts to that Western diet microbiome. And then the question is, when you operate in those animals, they have increased leak, anastomotic leaks, they have more sepsis, the mortality is higher. But if you take them and put them back on a rat chow, high fiber diet for just 2 days prior to operating, you lower the anastomosis rates, leak rates. And so we do that now in humans. You know, we say, okay, for the next couple of weeks before surgery, this is the diet. We give them the little Metamucil wafers as part of the study. And we check their microbiome and see. And guess what? We're seeing fewer leaks, and the patients have got a high fiber diet. And that's been done by Alberti too. He's shown that JAMA 2020 had a nice article, patients in colorectal surgery, they get a high fiber diet. In other words, getting the microbiome back to a more stable microbiome, not a pathobiome, but a stable microbiome, they have left fewer leaks, they have fewer complications. So that's the kind of thing we're going to go back to. It's easy, it's inexpensive, it's not $1 million pill or, you know, $500,000 worth of, you know, monoclonal antibodies, you know, mm-hmm. it's easy. Mm-hmm. But people have to realize you gotta go to the store and actually go to the produce department and buy some food that's got some fiber in it, you know.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think what we're referring to is probably what we would classify usually as prebiotics. I don't know if you use that term, Dr. Martindale, but sort of, you know, encouraging the growth of good bacteria. What would you, and I think we all have our different thoughts on probiotics, but what are your thoughts on that? And is there a role of that in clinical medicine?
I think, you know, you can spend a lot of money buying tablets, but you don't need that. If you buy just good, healthy food, your body will make the bacteria. You know, the prebiotic is the substrate and the fibers in the foods, whether it be whole grain foods or nuts or vegetables or fresh fruits and things. Your body won't, the bacteria will thrive on that. It only takes two or 3 days to change some of the microbiome back to a less pathogenic microbiome. And that's a cheap way to do it. You know, they shouldn't go buy all these probiotics. It's a waste of money. You know, I tell people if you want to get some probiotics, just buy a good probiotic yogurt, you know, and they're available nationwide in every grocery store in this country.
So Dr. Martindale, I know you see patients with like intracutaneous fistulas, and I think we've all like encountered these patients at times in our clinical practice or in the hospital. Can you tell me more about how, you know, what your thought process is when you're approaching these patients and how you manage them?
Yeah, you know, as my career is sort of closing, you might say here, I now am only doing mostly fistulas. You know, we've become a fistula center. We do 1 to 2 a week now of intercutaneous fistulas or enterovesical fistulas or whatever fistula it might be. And those are very difficult in nutrition because depending on where the lesion is in the gastrointestinal tract, we may or may not need parenteral nutrition. And then we may or may be able to feed distally through a pump system. You know, so there's lots of ways that these are a challenge nutritionally. And so, but they're very exciting because it takes a lot of planning, you know, and you have to get the person perfectly tuned for them to be able to tolerate a 6 or 8 or 10 hour operation. And then sometimes, I would say our average fistula duration of surgery is about 7 hours. Wow. So it's a long operation, very tedious, but you can really save people's a lot of grief, you know, if you do them right.
When you say getting them like tuned up and in the right spot, is some of that nutritional like rehabilitation?
Majority nutritional. You know, we've learned now that, you know, we've gone back and forth to how much protein to give and maybe there's some middle ground. But in these patients, clearly the protein and resistance exercise is the key. You know, we really need, you know, you can give all the protein you want, but if you can't get, you can't turn on muscle protein synthesis, it's not going to help you. So unless you're using the muscle with the resistance exercise, you're not going to uptake that protein very well. And that's been shown very well recently. That resistance exercise is the answer to getting this, and whether it's preoperatively for a month or postoperatively. You know, part of my gig now is doing the pre-op preparation of patients for major surgery in our clinic. We have a pre-op clinic. And that, whether it be neurosurgery, orthopedic surgery, general surgery, all of those patients come to our pre-op clinic. And that clinic requires a aggressive dietitian who works in our clinic, who goes over what their diets are and what they should eat in the next month. You know, most of our protocols require 4 grams of fish oils a day based on work by McGlory showing we can decrease the loss of protein during immobilization, muscle protein, and it enhances rate of recovery of muscle protein synthesis. So it's a very aggressive nutritional plan, but all that's part of, you know, an exercise program. If they walk in a walker, that's fine. If they don't get out of bed because they've got some other issue with mobility, especially the elderly population, we give them hand weights and things they can do with their upper body. Because it doesn't take a specific muscle to use, it just takes muscle utilization to enhance muscle protein synthetic ability. And that works throughout the body, not just the muscle being used.
Interesting. Okay. So any resistance exercise is better than none. Is what you're
absolutely saying. Even if it's just upper body little weights, I tell them if they, you know, can get 1 or 2 pound weights and use those, or just get a can of soup, you know, out of the cupboard and lift that if that's all they've got, you know.
Interesting, Dr. Martindale. I mean, I think we obviously deal with different populations. You know, I deal with a pediatric population, and your population obviously a different older. How do you get them motivated to get into resistance exercises? How do you explain that?
Well, it takes a sales pitch. You know, you've got to say, look, how much do you want to get better? And they got to get buy-in. If they don't get buy-in, if they just lay there in bed and don't do anything, I said, well, we're not going to do your surgery. you know, we're going to wait because you're not ready. Your body's not ready to tolerate this operation. And usually they're so sick of not having a problem. You know, I just recently operated on a little child, 2-year-old, who unfortunately got run over. And we spent 13 hours in his belly, you know. But kids, you don't have to worry about motivation. They want to get back up and play, you know. And it was pretty shocking to me because I don't operate on very few kids. I operate on very few children, but they called me over our children's hospital to help out with this case. Mm-hmm. And so it was quite a shock. You don't have to motivate those kids. All you can do is just, you know, they want to get up and play. So if they're feeling reasonably well, they get up and play.
Yeah.
But that fish did well, yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome, Dr. Martineau. Thank you for sharing that. So you kind of touched on this briefly here about, you know, SPMs and I guess the future of clinical care. Where do you feel like nutrition is going, like in general? You know, I think you've been around Aspen for several years, been in the field of nutrition for several years. What's the future?
I think we're in a point now where if our job now is going to be sell it to the public. Because we have data. We've got the data to say what they need and what they need, you know, what we can do. So the key now is just getting it, sort of roll that out to the public so they accept it. You know, and the fellowship, you mentioned already the Nestle Nutrition Fellowship. It's in our 13th year teaching, you know, 6 or 7 young physicians a year. And, you know, there are a lot of people out there now, like yourself, you know, that are. So we're getting there. You know, we're almost there. I think we've got the data to make it work. And so it's now, you know, I was a 42nd member of Aspen. My number is 00042. You know, wow. I was a grad student when I joined Aspen, and I've watched it grow, and I think it's got a chance to really make an impact. You know, but we have, it takes work, you know, to do it.
Yeah, I agree. I think, I mean, Aspen's a great organization. I love the, you know, multidisciplinary collaborative nature of everybody at Aspen. I'm looking forward to the meeting later this month. I will you be attending, Dr. Martineau?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
All right. Awesome. Well, any final words here, Dr. Martineau, before we wrap up?
No, I think that sounds great. I think I don't have anything else to say. I think we're in good standing. I think the key is data, and that's what we have now. So we just got to get the word out.
All right. Well, excellent talking to you, Dr. Martineau. Thank you for spending this
good
time.
Good talk to you, Vikram. Enjoyed it. All right. I'll see you in a couple weeks at Aspen.
See you in a few weeks.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks.